Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, David Dry, and today we have the pleasure to be talking with Denise Bates about her new book, Basket Diplomacy, Leadership, Alliance Building, and Resilience Among the Coushatta Tribe of Louisiana, 1884 to 1984, published in 2020 by the University of Nebraska Press. This tribal history traces the careful diplomacy of the Coushatta Tribe of Louisiana as they forge cooperative relations with local, state, and national politicians, business leaders, and intertribal organizations. For decades, the Coushatta Tribe of Louisiana struggled to secure federal Indian services, and through alliance-building activism and leveraging opportunities at key moments, tribal leaders over generations succeeded in expanding the resources available to the community while simultaneously working to protect tribal culture and identity. Denise Bates, welcome to the show.
Why, thank you. It's great to be here.
I wonder if you could... Great to have you. I wonder if you could start off by telling us a little about you and your background as a scholar.
Oh, certainly. Well, presently, I'm an assistant professor of leadership and integrative studies at Arizona State University with affiliations in history and sustainability. I'm Choctaw Creek and Cherokee descent with roots in Alabama and Oklahoma. Would you like me to get a little bit into the reason why this book came about?
Absolutely. That'd be wonderful.
Okay, certainly. So this book was inspired by my previous book project called The Other Movement, Indian Rights and Civil Rights in the Deep South, that came out in 2012, where I examined how Southern tribes negotiated their relationships with their respective state governments in the mid-20th century. And this was against the backdrop of desegregation and civil rights activism, long before gaming became a point of contention. And in the other movement, I focused on Alabama and Louisiana. And although there were also activities across the region that had similar outcomes, namely increased activism that shaped the path for the establishment of state-level Indian Affairs commissions and contributed to reshaping federal Indian policy. And so while this initial book had been focused more on the structural aspects of this intertribal movement, I've long been interested in shifting the focus to look more at the internal struggles and efforts from a tribal perspective. And so right after The Other Movement came out in 2012, I was invited by the Coushatta Tribal Council to give a talk on Southern Indian activism on their reservation in their auditorium. And the place was packed with both tribal citizens and their longtime non-Indian neighbors, allies, and friends. And this experience, coupled with the conversations I had afterwards with Coushatta elders and the former tribal chairman, Mr. Ernest Sickey, who was the chairman from 1973 to 1982. And this conversation helped to spark the early development of this recent book, Basket Diplomacy. And so that's sort of how it came about. I can get into some more details if you're interested, but I'll go ahead and let you go ahead and ask me some questions.
No, I'm very interested in the process. And so you mentioned, you know, in the introduction to the book that, you know, there were hundreds of hours of interviews. And so I wonder if you could discuss, you know, your general approach towards writing a community-based history and this story, obviously, in particular.
Oh, certainly. Well, I'll start with getting back to Mr. Sickey, who really was instrumental in the creation of this book. I mean, I really consider him a partner and collaborator in every sense of the word. He was, and just to give you a little bit more background, he was at the forefront of the Indian movement in Louisiana, involved in establishing the Louisiana Office of Indian Affairs, and getting the Coushatta tribe to become the first tribe recognized by the state of Louisiana in 1972. And then not very long after, reinstated to a federally acknowledged status in 1973, after they had been unilaterally and without congressional approval terminated in 1953. So it was a great honor to be invited to document their history and to be welcomed by the community to collect the oral histories. The process, you know, took several years, but I had the great pleasure of being able to sit and talk with not only tribal members, but many of their friends, political allies, business associates. And so it was just, it felt like I had the opportunity to just sit and visit, even though there was a book project behind it. It was quite fun, I have to say. And everyone, their enthusiasm and their support around the project really helped to keep the momentum going.
Wonderful. And thank you for sharing kind of the details of how this came about and the kind of very community-driven nature of the work. And you mentioned you initially wanted to focus on the 1970s and Coushatta state relations, but, you know, eventually you realized you needed to go back and look, you know, at the 1880s and the settlement at Bayou Blue. And so I wonder if you could tell us a little bit about what led you to that decision, and also just introduce the Coushatta a little bit and you know, those early days at Bayou Blue and why that period is important.
Oh, certainly. Well, as you mentioned, the initial intent was to focus on the 1970s, in particular, Mr. Sickey and all of the work that he had done around his leadership and his time as chairman. But he made quite a compelling case that this was really a community-wide intergenerational effort. And as a result, I decided to widen the historical scope of this project, which was absolutely the right call. So I'm really grateful to him for that kind of guidance. In terms of the community itself, just to back up a little bit and offer a little bit of a timeline, before getting to their final home, which is around Bayou Blue, it's important to give this background and follow the pattern or understanding that of their migration story. So without getting into too much detail, in 1540 was the first reference to the Coushatta community by Spanish explorer Hernando de Soto, who first encountered them in the Tennessee River Basin. By the 1700s, records show them migrating to the area where the Coosa and Tallapoosa rivers converge and joined the Creek Confederacy in present-day Alabama, where Coushatta leaders signed treaties, which is very significant later when telling their history, because this political relationship was established and it was later called into question by the federal government. By the early 19th century, groups of Coushattas made the decision to move westward to avoid the influx of non-Indian settlers, and they joined groups of Alabamas who took a familiar journey that eventually brought them to Texas. Today, there are Coushatta families in Oklahoma, Texas, Louisiana. There's a family still in Alabama as well. So this book is about, to focus it more, is about the 200 to 300 Coushattas who, after briefly living in Texas, redirected their movement eastward into Louisiana just as the Civil War was winding down. And by the 1880s, they began to acquire homesteads in southwest Louisiana in what later became Allen Parish. So the first few decades of the 20th century, the tribe struggled to gain access to federal Indian services at the same time that the Mississippi Choctaw and Alabama Coushatta of Texas were undergoing their own struggles, which did influence the Louisiana Coushattas. They experienced quite a few barriers. Early on, they were considered refugee Indians that had been off the federal radar for so many decades by this time, especially once you get into the early 20th century. And so federal officials, as I mentioned, didn't understand their history, and they resisted the notion that Coushattas joined the Creek Confederacy previously in negotiating treaties. In other words, there were no pre-existing federal relationship. At least that was the argument that was made by federal officials. One interesting thing I will point out in this context of Southwest Louisiana is that the Coushattas, unlike many other tribes across the state of Louisiana and even the region, were permitted to attend white schools in Elton long before the parish was forced to desegregate in 1965. Many arguments exist as to why this was. The main one being that the parish employed a stringent binary racial structure that cared more about what the Coushattas weren't rather than what they were. And as an insular community, the tribe was acknowledged as and self-proclaimed their status as full-blooded Indians. which further was further emphasized by the fact that Kosati was their primary language, which left many Kushadage children struggling in school. And then they use their baskets as a way of further emphasizing that their indigenous identities in the region. However, in spite of the struggles, by the 1930s, the tribe succeeded in getting federal agents out to the community to assess their situation, and soon limited funding for education and medical care followed. So that was how the federal government or the federal relationship really emerged among this particular community. But that was short-lived because, as I mentioned previously, by 1953, the passing of the Indian Termination Policy, the Kushada tribe was one that was abandoned. And I say abandoned because they weren't officially terminated through the congressional action. It's simply what happened is two federal agents appeared in the community one day, and in spite of the tribe writing a letter stating that it was not their wish to be terminated, they were nonetheless unilaterally cut off from federal services. Their school was shut down. Healthcare funds were cut off, and so forth. And so this is one of those stories that really, the oral histories that I collected and in talking to the community members really gave a lot more depth and nuance and understanding of that time. Because not only did the BIA discontinue services to the Kushadas, the impact of the policy itself obscured the tribe even further. It consistently left them out of follow-up reports and, by extension, scholarship that later emerged around the termination period. The Kushadas, time and time again, are completely left out of that scholarship. So I think I'll stop there and let you. I feel like I'm talking quite a lot.
Oh, no, thank you. That's the whole point of this. And I appreciate you giving us that overview of kind of the first half, if you will, of the book and that narrative arc. And, you know, I think it really does hit home that, you know, termination policy, while it has, you know, reverberations throughout the country, we think of generally in the general narrative as only affecting kind of a small percentage of tribes through formal termination laws. And the Kushada experience really pushes back on that narrative, showing kind of the many guises in which termination policy manifests itself. And so I think, you know, it's an important story that is undertold, and it affects not just the Kushada, but, you know, other groups as well. But I think you really bring this experience to life in the book. And to go back briefly to the 1930s and the 40s, you know, the book is kind of this inside-outside relationship. They have this back and forth with the OIA or the BIA in terms of services, where, you know, they have them at one moment, they fought for them and secure them, and then they're taken away once again, and they have to fight for their rights as Indian people once more. And to go back to that earlier period in the 1930s and 1940s, could you talk a little bit about the types of activism that the tribe was engaged in, and how they were ultimately successful after decades of trying, finally achieving at least some, even if modest, services and recognition of their rights as Indian people?
Oh, certainly. And I would even push it back even further to the 19-teens, when Chief Jackson Langley, who, and looking at the census records, it appeared that, you know, he didn't declare that he spoke English or was able to read and write until it was a very short period of time. So in other words, he really took the reins early on at the turn of the century to sort of negotiate the social terrain in which his community lived. And what that resulted in was several letters that he had written. He actually worked with other tribal members who were in leadership roles with the Indian church, for example. And there's this one case that in the 1920s, where two of them actually make a trip to Alexandria to meet with a lawyer, and encouraging the lawyer to assist them with some land claims rights. And so it really was quite shocking to me to find it so early on. But then when I started making the connection to what was happening with the Mississippi Choctaws, it all made sense. So that there was this understanding by the Kushada of what was happening in Mississippi and being influenced by sort of the courage and the activism that was being employed by the Mississippi Choctaw during that time. So that's a one very clear cut case of activism, of reaching out to legal counsel to try and get some assistance, as well as some state legislators as well. And so there's quite a few early, in those early decades, there's quite a few examples of that happening. The one thing though with the Coushatta that was very interesting is this intergenerational, these initial contacts with non-Indian folks around the community and these relationships that were built proved later on through the generations to be extremely valuable. Making these connections, creating these alliances and these long enduring friendships, they may not have come to fruition in terms of the extent or the value of them and at the time that they were initiated, but later, as you get into the 1960s and 70s, they really did emerge as providing the tribe with a strong foundation in the region locally. And so I think it's important to not discount those local relationships that were established that then sort of had a rippling effect in placing them within the state and then the national context later in the 1970s, when it was some of these same folks, or at least the descendants of these folks, who were going to bat for the tribe and supporting their efforts. And so for the early decades, that's what I would identify as some of this leaders going out and sort of curating these relationships, both locally and a little further abroad.
Thank you for that. And so we can dive into some of these themes a little more. Maybe we can finish out kind of the narrative arc of the book. And so I wonder if you could talk about the fourth and fifth chapters a little bit, which to me seem like kind of the heart of the book, the 1960s, the 1970s, where the tribe is undertaking new economic ventures, gaining a reaffirmation of their federal recognition. And, as a way of talking about that story, I wonder if you could also introduce us to a person you've already talked about quite a bit, but Ernest Sickey is really kind of the mover and shaker here that is profiled. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about him and his role in spearheading a lot of these endeavors.
Certainly. So Ernest Sickey, it's sort of difficult to talk about him without first introducing his father into the narrative, which was Davis Sickey. Davis Sickey didn't hold an elected leadership role within the community, but played a key role in helping to develop these relationships, as I was just discussing with key people around the community who had some political clout and power economically as well in the state of Louisiana. And so Davis, I just want to back up a little bit, because in 1963, there's this sort of really interesting situation or case that happened when immediately after President Johnson issued a war on poverty, there's this great story of Davis picking up the newspaper and reading about this, and sort of the light bulb going off of, okay, here's another opportunity for us to really rally for some support for the community. And so he went and met with Chief Martin Abbey, who was the last traditional chief of the community, and the two of them went and sought assistance of a local lawyer. Again, this familiar pattern of reaching out to legal counsel. And this lawyer, they encouraged him to go to Washington, D.C. and make a case for the tribe to Sergeant Shriver, who was, among other things at the time, the director of the Johnson administration's anti-poverty programs. And unsurprisingly, they sent the lawyer with a basket to gift to Shriver. And this made big news at the time. Again, this feeds into the title of this book, was Basket Diplomacy. So nothing came of this. However, it really began to lay the groundwork for continued efforts of gaining influence and finding additional allies. And so, and this really had an impact on Ernest, who was growing up observing all of this. you know, his father used to take him to, in Ernest's words, I grew up in the courthouse. My father would always take me to the courthouse, the local courthouse, so that I can see how the American legal system worked. And so that I can understand the language that people are using and the mannerisms that they're deploying. And as a way of me absorbing it and becoming more effective as I grew into a leadership role. And so Ernest Sickey really had a very unusual childhood. He would even acknowledge that for sure. But in the sense that he, on one hand, was getting a very, very traditional education in the community. He spent a lot of time with the elders in the community. But then on the flip side of that, his father was taking him to legal conferences as a child so that he was able to have an understanding and demystify this legal system. And so at a very young age, he went away to college for a few years in Houston, joined the Air Force, eventually made his way back to the community. Even though he had big aspirations for himself professionally, he just could not leave his community behind, given the poverty. Many families were still getting their water from wells. There very few families had electricity in the 1960s, by the time he was really coming of age and making these decisions. And so he decided that he was going to dedicate himself to the tribe. And that's indeed what he did. So he worked a full-time job outside of the community so that he can pay his bills. And he got married. He had a large family. And to support them, he had the job outside of the community. But at night, it was his time to work on helping to get the tribe in a position where they can petition the government, the federal government, for being reestablished. And so that's there are all sorts of great stories, and some of my favorite stories that came from this project had to do with that time period when he would work in a he actually encouraged, or he was able to persuade the manager of a local refinery, because it's all oil in that area, and there was a refinery down the road from his home. And of course, during the day, it was quite active, but at night, everyone went home. So he persuaded the manager of the refinery to let him use the office at night so that he would have a quiet place to sit with a typewriter and write letters to legislators and write grants and whatever other kind of work he was doing on behalf of the tribe. And so there's fun stories in the community about the lights being on in the refinery office. So people would drive by and honk their horn to acknowledge so they would acknowledge that they knew he was in there working on behalf of the community. And so it's a lot of hard work, and it wasn't just him. He had a lot of support, and a lot of others in the community stepped up, whether it would be helping him type letters, or going with him to Washington, D.C., and sitting at the table and having meetings with folks and just introducing who they are as a tribe to sort of give that sort of that representation. And so, yeah, it was a long haul for certain, but it paid off. And as I mentioned, and it really started with in 1972, when the state of Louisiana passed a resolution to recognize the Coushatas as a state-recognized tribe. And within a year, some of those same legislators really went to bat for them in Washington, D.C., along with other organizations such as the Association on American Indian Affairs. And they put together a case for them, and within that year, they were reinstated to a federally acknowledged status. So this is, it's a watered-down version, but there's a lot of nuance and a lot of hard work that I certainly came to appreciate in not just looking through the archival materials and all the correspondence, but through the oral histories as well.
No, and you know, that scene that you talked about of him, you know, with the lights on writing, certainly is actually one of the ones that stuck with me reading the book, and how, you know, he was this kind of mediator in that a lot of people, you know, tribal members didn't necessarily understand the importance or the significance of what he was trying to accomplish. And it seemed like at times it was lonely work. But he saw the significance of it for the tribal community and pursued it in spite of that. And so it was really a beautiful, beautiful story. And you know, you mentioned all of these connections that the tribe created with local officials, with state officials, with community members, you know, in the local area. And oftentimes I think we think of tribes in particular as having an adversarial relationship with state and local officials in particular. And this is a different story. Can you discuss a little bit how the Kushada navigated those dynamics and exerted sovereignty while maintaining good relations with state and local officials?
Ooh, and that's a great question. Well, there's a lot of different ways I can go about talking about this. For one, I just want to back up and reiterate the quite unique experience that Kushada people had in given access to white spaces and being integrated into white schools. There certainly was a lot of hardship and a lot of discrimination that many of them expressed, but there was also access, and rather early access, and which certainly helped to shape relationships with, you know, the town of Elton in particular, where there's a long-standing relationship between tribal leadership and the mayor of Elton. And there are many cases in over time with different mayors being involved. Once you get into the 1960s and 70s, that relationship becomes even more solid around the tourism, because the town of Elton becomes to really rely on the tribe for tourism, for encouraging outsiders to come and patronize Elton businesses. And so that really kind of helped to shape the dynamic of the relationship locally. And another aspect of this as well, which is a consistent message that tribal leadership had always expressed in a variety of ways. It became more honed over time. But this notion of, if you help us, we're going to give back in some way. So helping us is helping yourself. And so to put it into the context of this region in which the tribe lives, I mean, the Jefferson Davis and Allen Parishes, which is where the location that I'm talking about, were some of the most impoverished parishes in Louisiana at this time. And so, you know, poverty wasn't just an Indian problem. They had relationships with Cajun families who sort of aligned themselves economically with the tribe. And so there's this whole other factor of the economics and this sort of shared impoverished state of things. And so that really helped to, not necessarily with leadership, but with neighbors. And I'm not sure if I'm answering your question, but there's a lot to this. And there certainly were situations where there was some conflict, particularly over land. With the homesteads that Kushadas began to acquire in the 1880s, over time, and there's very little documentary record to follow exactly what happened, but essentially a lot of that acreage began to diminish quite dramatically, and many of it through fraudulent acts of non-Indians coming in and taking the land, in other cases, because all but one Kushada homesteader, they used the General Homestead Act as a way of gaining land. And so they had taxes, and many of them were unable to pay the taxes and lost land for that reason. And so there was some tension and some hostility around land, and the court cases. There were several court cases, actually, that came through. Nothing that amounted to anything dramatic, but it was enough for me to really see where some of those tensions were. And it was really around land, particularly the Bell Oil, which is the Bell family owned a lot of the acreage around the tribe, and also was the family that began to acquire the land that tribal members began to lose over time. So I don't want to paint this picture that it was all rosy. It certainly was not, but leadership certainly exercised strategy and were extremely savvy in how they were able to navigate the politics in spite of some of these hardships.
So not an absence of conflict by any means, just, as you're saying, the skilled diplomacy to navigate those waters and to find enough common ground for the tribe to kind of accomplish the ends that it seeks. It brings me kind of back to the title of your book, which you mentioned, Basket Diplomacy. And, these baskets certainly are used, as a tool of diplomacy, but also seem as if they symbolize, economic self-sufficiency, they're a marker of Kashada identity. And I wonder if you could, talk about them a little bit more, both kind of the traditional role and that they served within the community and how they came to serve kind of this broader function and were one part of that navigating of those complex relationships with various entities.
Oh, certainly. And so let me just say, first of all, basket diplomacy was a term that was coined by Ernest Zicke himself. We were actually sitting and having breakfast one morning, and we were talking about this very issue. And he says it's like as if we were using our baskets as a form of diplomacy. And then we both paused, and he said, "I think that should be the name of the book." And so that's just to give a little bit of background as to where that term came from. I just want to make sure I credit him for it because he certainly was, in that moment, it was like a synergy that he he determined that was the appropriate way to frame this entire book, which I agreed. I think it really hit the nail on the head. So in terms of the baskets, I'd like to defer to my co-author of another book that's coming up which is what I see as sort of an enhancement or a partner book to Basket Diplomacy, which is coming out through LSU Press next year, and it's Louisiana Kashada Basket Makers. And my co-author is Dr. Linda Langley, who's the tribal preservation officer, and she said that basketry is woven into the very fabric of Kashada identity, quite literally. I mean, she really gets into quite a lot of detail. But what she means here is that absolutely all of those things it's used for as a form of diplomacy and sharing, but it's also, for many, many generations, a means of survival. Baskets were used as tools for bartering and trading for necessities. They became boosters of the tribal economy by the mid-20th century as the Kashadas launched a tourism venture. They've also been an anchor for maintaining their social and cultural cohesion, with the gathering and selling process being a very community-driven endeavor. The teaching of basket making to the younger generations also reflects the value of the community. And then finally, baskets also represent the fluidity of Kashada cultural practices and willingness to adapt to changing environments as the early transition from weaving river cane baskets to sewing longleaf pine baskets attests, which through this migration, as I mentioned, from the Tennessee River Basin to Alabama and on westward and then back to Louisiana, the environment changes. And so this notion of adapting to the environment and using the materials that are available is very much reflected in the Kashada basket tradition. And then finally, as you mentioned, the gifting of baskets to political leaders and influential people was and still is a strategic move to generate interest in their culture that has something unique to offer. but at the same time, something to lose. And so it's a reminder of what may be lost if efforts are not maintained to maintain the cultural continuity and cohesion within the tribe.
Thank you for that. And I'm interested in that idea of adaptation, because certainly one of the strengths of a community-based history like this is grasping kind of the continuity across multiple generations in terms of the relationships that they have with various, you know, outside groups. And you can see a lot of those through lines. And I wonder if you could discuss a little bit how tribal leaders or tribal members are simultaneously shaped by some of the national and perhaps even international developments going on in, you know, the 1960s, 1970s, or even potentially in the 1930s and 1940s in terms of their activism.
National policy? Well, national policy often framed Coushatta's strategic political actions. I had mentioned the case with Davis Sickey in 1963 with the newspaper proclaiming President Johnson's war on poverty. But then this continues on with the constantly paying attention to what is happening nationally, getting involved with other tribes. So this sort of coalition building effort that occurred. So the Coushattas were not just operating in isolation, you know, back to, as I mentioned, the turn of the century, they're paying attention to what's going on in Mississippi. They were paying attention to what was happening in Texas with the Alabama Coushatta reservation. And this continued on. But within the state of Louisiana, the Coushattas were at the forefront of really creating these intertribal efforts. So, for example, in 1972, the same year that the Coushatta became recognized by the state of Louisiana, they helped to create the Intertribal Council of Louisiana, as well as the Louisiana Office of Indian Affairs, which both were a coalition of several tribes, including the Chittimacha, who were previously federally recognized in 1916. And so they were able to build these coalitions and work with state legislators and then expand that, eventually getting involved with USET, which is the United Southern and Eastern Tribes, where Mr. Sickey had joined the ranks early on of other tribal leaders across the Southeast and East to influence the development of the Indian Self-Determination and Education Assistance Act. So there was quite a lot of influence that was coming from around and paying attention to what was happening with other tribes, not just in the region, but nationally. But on the flip side of that, having an impact themselves in influencing what was going on. And, you know, the Coushattas later led the charge in introducing Indian gaming into Louisiana. Which resulted in a landmark court case that reaffirmed their sovereign right to exercise jurisdiction over tribal lands. And so they were a part of a bigger movement, but they also were at the forefront within Louisiana, along with the Chittimacha, Tunica Biloxi, the Jena Choctaw, and so on. And so it's none of this happened in isolation. There's quite a few connections that one could make.
And so, to that end, could you tell a little bit about some of the ways you hope historians of American Indian history or American history more generally can benefit from looking at this particular experience and perspective?
Sure. So my advice to others is first that there is great value in community-driven narratives. Let the stories tell the history, even if it goes into directions you didn't expect, which that certainly happened in the case of this book project. Historians sometimes have a tendency to be inflexible and document-driven in their work, and sometimes that is the only way, or that's the only information we have. But in projects where one has living sources to consult, this is a gift that shouldn't be squandered, in my opinion. And so I was really fortunate to be able to have that opportunity. But also, follow the thread of relationships. This was important in writing a book about multiple generations. Not only did uncovering the family connections between people become important, but in following friendships between Kushadas and non-Kushadas over generations, revealed how these relationships served as a stabilizing force for the tribe as it increased its political and economic presence in the area. And now there are many more points I can make, but the one final one that I would like to say is share with the tribe. Use the opportunity to contribute your efforts to the tribe's efforts in building their own resources, whether that be archives, libraries, or museums.
Thank you for that. And I know, you know, undoubtedly your work has been curtailed by the ongoing pandemic, but I wonder if you could talk about your, you know, future plans and ongoing relationship with the Kushada tribe. And you mentioned that you're working on another book project. Could you talk a little bit about that as well?
Well, certainly. So as I had started to mention, and this book project is actually in press now, so it's beyond the so we spent last summer writing it, but it's taking this vast amount of resources that the Kushada Tribal Archive has been collecting from within the community, and then pairing that up with the materials that I was able to collect for Basket Diplomacy. And so it really was such a wonderful way to bring an assortment of materials together. And it also initiated additional oral histories that were conducted by tribal members in Kosari. And so this is the thing I'm very excited about, that many of these basket makers were interviewed by younger tribal members in their own language. And so the time it took to do that, and then to also translate it and prepare it so that we could use it for Louisiana Kushada basket makers, the book, that it was well worth the time that we put into that. But that book is really an effort, and it came out of initially, at least on my end, of this sense that although Basket Diplomacy does incorporate the voices of the dozens and dozens of basket makers who were involved in producing these beautiful woven treasures for people like Ernest Sickey and those who came before him, who carried them around the country and gifted them, I just didn't feel like I was able to give them enough space for them to really shine, because that role they played is another form of leadership. And it was certainly a collective effort. And so when Linda Langley and I began speaking, and she told me that she's always had this vision for 30 years, she's been thinking that she would like to write a book about the basket makers. And I said, yes, let's do it, because this will be that opportunity to devote a whole volume to these basket makers that are primarily women, but male Kushadas also weave baskets. So there's no gender markers even in their language. But over time, it was mostly the women who began to be the primary basket makers, because that was the role that they played within their family in terms of bringing in income. So the Louisiana Kushada Basket Makers, it's its own book, but it makes me very happy that it is a book devoted to the voices of those basket makers and how not only that they've been able to maintain this tradition, but more importantly, how they've been able to share it across generations, and how it's not something that we're studying as part of the past. The basket making tradition in the Kushada community is alive and well. It's in fact the epilogue of this new book is written by two younger basket makers who are part of multiple generations that go way back. And so they're reflecting that future of this art form.
Wonderful. And as I reflect on a few of your books, you know, the other movement kind of is this comparative piece looking at two states and multiple tribal groups. And this is a story of, you know, leadership and the tribe, and you're getting now even into a more specific group within the tribe. And I feel like with each one, you're drawing in new insights, obviously, and things that weren't there in the previous works. And I think it's wonderful the way that you're building off of the things that you had started long before.
It has been a wonderful journey.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us a little bit about your work and for being on the podcast today.
Oh, my pleasure. It's been a blast. Thank you so much.
Denise Bates is an historian and assistant professor of leadership and integrative studies at Arizona State University. Her new book is Basket Diplomacy, Leadership, Alliance Building, and Resilience Among the Coushatta Tribe of Louisiana, 1884 to 1984, and it is now available from the University of Nebraska Press.